On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's a new Supreme Court since John Roberts and Sam Alito came on board, and last week saw the proof in the pudding. The High Court's 5-4 decision on a closely watched abortion case essentially reversed a similar case of 7 years ago when Justice Sandra Day O'Connor was the swing vote on the court. Now the Roberts Court is lined up to decide cases on campaign finance and free speech, schools and race, and much more. It's a new world on the High Court that could reshape your world. Up next on Point, after the abortion decision, the way ahead for the court that George W. Bush built. Later this hour, we'll look at how the High Court's abortion ruling is playing out on the presidential campaign trail. But joining me first today from Washington is Jan Crawford Greenberg, longtime legal affairs correspondent for the Chicago Tribune and now for ABC News. She's author of the new book, and it's terrific, Supreme Conflict, the inside story of the struggles for control of the United States Supreme Court. Jan, thanks very much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Good to have you. Also from Washington, Jeffrey Rosen is with us, professor of law at George Washington University. He wrote a deep profile of Chief Justice John Roberts entitled Roberts Rules for the Atlantic Monthly. He's author of The Supreme Court, The Personalities and Rivalries That Defined America. Jeffrey Rosen, welcome back. Great to have you with us.
Good to be here.
Jan Crawford Greenberg, let me go first to you and look at this ruling on abortion last week. Take us into the dynamics of this. How did this decision unfold? 5-4 to support the ban on partial birth abortion, as the law calls it. Give us the genesis of this ruling, which looks like it goes the other way from the last time the court visited this issue with Sandra Day O'Connor on board.
Right, it certainly does, because it was just 7 years ago that the Supreme Court struck down similar state laws, saying that the Constitution, you know, just did not allow those efforts. But that was a new court. We had Justice Sandra Day O'Connor on the court then. We've now got Justice Alito on board. So this decision was 5-4, written by Justice Kennedy. Kennedy was in dissent in 2000. Now, you know, Justice Kennedy.
Meaning he was with Sandra Day O'Connor.
No.
So he's been consistent here.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Right. So and so don't be surprised about that. Mm-hmm. Justice O'Connor cast her vote with the more liberal justices in 2000, leaving Justice Kennedy in dissent with the conservatives. And so some people had really pinned their hopes on Justice Kennedy in this case, because, as you said, he was consistent here, but sometimes he's not always so consistent. But in this case, decided last week, he wrote the majority opinion very, very similar to what he wrote in dissent 7 years ago in that other partial birth abortion case. So that, with Justice Alito on board, replacing Justice O'Connor, we've got five justices now upholding these federal partial birth abortion laws. And I think the decision is highly, highly significant. It's really a dramatic change for this Supreme Court. Justice Kennedy's opinion makes clear that states are going to have an important role in this debate, that he believed the Supreme Court has undervalued that role, that states can make moral choices. This is quite different language than we've seen from the Supreme Court, and it's going to allow states to pass greater laws restricting abortion, regulating abortion. I'm not saying that the court's going to strike down Roe versus Wade. I don't think it will do that, but it is going to allow more restriction and more regulation on abortion.
Jeffrey Rosen, how do you see the new complexion emerging with this court then? Do we have an established conservative court? Is it fair to call it that at this point? Are we still in a kind of swing mode with Kennedy this way here and maybe another way the next time?
Very much in a swing way. Far from being the Roberts court, this is entirely the Kennedy court. He's the one who controls the balance. And in this sense, this is a quintessentially Kennedy opinion. I think Jan is absolutely right that he's entirely consistent with what he wrote in the partial birth case a few years ago. And for him, it was in that case that he felt almost betrayed by his decision to uphold the core of Roe v. Wade. When he upheld Roe in 1992, he made clear that he thought that the bargain that he'd struck was that early-term abortion had to be protected, but late-term abortions could be restricted. And when the five liberals said that partial birth laws, even though they often came late in pregnancy, were unconstitutional a few years ago, he said that wasn't what I was signing on for. In his mind, he's just upholding that original bargain, and in that sense, the core of Roe is not at all under threat. I think Jan is right that that's not what the court is doing here. He sees this as upholding modest and in some ways largely symbolic laws that won't actually deny any women abortions, but which matter intensely to the pro-life side. So it's hard to read from this decision a sign of a radical shift leftward, because there are, or rather rightward, because there are plenty of issues on which Kennedy will still side with the liberals. It's quintessentially a Kennedy opinion, and it just reminds us that at the moment he's running the show.
So Jan, look forward with us then. There are many more cases coming for the docket with some real weight on them. And I'm reading here, it may not be a dyed-in-the-wool conservative court, but the chance for some real conservative movement in cases looming. Walk us through some of those, if you would, Jen.
No, Tom, there's no question. And, I mean, obviously, last week's decision was the one that I think was most significant for this court. But we're going to get another decision between now and the end of June that also will show this court's going in a different direction than it did when Justice O'Connor was on board. That's a case involving voluntary efforts to integrate schools and have children in Louisville and Seattle. They had programs there where students were not going to their community schools, but were being bused across city just to try to keep some kind of racial balance. That case, I think, is pretty clear after the argument the Supreme Court is going to strike down those voluntary efforts to integrate schools. Again, that's a different approach than I believe this court would have taken if Justice O'Connor were on board. So I agree with Jeffrey. I think he's absolutely right that, you know, this court, we can't say, is now this solidly conservative court. Sure, we've got Justice Kennedy. He's the swing vote now, taking Justice O'Connor's place in that position. So you've got four solid judicial conservatives. You've got Roberts, our new Justice Alito, Thomas, and Scalia. Then you've got the four more liberal justices with Stevens, Ginsburg, Souter, and Breyer. And so then, of course, that leaves Kennedy in the middle. But when we think about the direction of this court, it's not going to be like the O'Connor court, because Anthony Kennedy is just more conservative than O'Connor was. You know, as we saw last week in the partial birth abortion case, as we're going to see in the weeks to come in that school busing and the race case, affirmative action issues. On many cases, religion, for example, Kennedy takes a more conservative approach. And I also think that our new Chief Justice, John Roberts, will have much greater success and persuading Kennedy to join conservatives on some of the issues that he might not have gone across that line before with our old Chief Justice William Rehnquist, who didn't try to build coalitions to that degree.
We'll look at why John Roberts might be more effective in bringing Justice Kennedy on board. Jeffrey Rosen, here Jan points to the cases around schools and race. The head of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund says that the promise made 52 years ago in Brown versus Board of Education is on the table here. McCain-Feingold and campaign finance reform also coming up for this court. I think they begin to hear arguments on that this week, on Wednesday, if I've got that right. Might we see that law overturned by this court?
We might indeed. Because, as Jan suggests, Kennedy, at least on the issues we're talking about, has a more categorical approach than Justice O'Connor.
What do you mean by that?
It's not that he's always more conservative, I think. It's he's less willing to split the difference. He's broader. Contrast O'Connor, who never saw a difference she wasn't willing to split. She would like to find moderate compromises and so forth. To Kennedy, who prefers these broad, sweeping statements. If you read his opinion in the partial birth case, he has this remarkable passage talking about how women's choice to raise children is ennobled by the moral struggle that they have. Justice Ginsburg saw that was a form of resurrecting the kind of discredited paternalism that the court had rejected in past cases. Kennedy just has a weakness for broad, sweeping gestures. He was ridiculed by his colleagues for saying liberty finds no refuge in a jurisprudence of doubt in the abortion case. You know, some people like it as poetry, others think it's a little bit grandiose, but the point is that when he finds a position, he's willing to extend it to its broadest implications. That's why in the race cases, where Justice O'Connor was willing to say a little affirmative action is okay, but not too much, Kennedy prefers the sweeping conclusion. The Constitution is colorblind, and therefore no race consciousness is permitted. In the campaign finance cases, O'Connor looked at it like a legislator and said, this is reasonable and this isn't. Kennedy says the First Amendment protects speech and money is speech, and therefore we have to allow these regulations to be struck down. That doesn't mean to say that there aren't issues in which Kennedy is more liberal than O'Connor would have been. In gay rights, for example, remember it was Kennedy who wrote this very sweeping opinion saying that because of the importance of protecting the dignity of gays and lesbians, all sodomy laws had to fall. Justice O'Connor said, no, I would have just struck down the four sodomy laws that target gays and lesbians and would have allowed states to regulate morality more broadly. But because Kennedy is so sweeping and because he's in the driver's seat right now, whatever he thinks is the law of the land, and it'll have much broader implications in a conservative direction in the cases in which he sides with the conservatives.
Jan, then a less pragmatic court in the Sandra Day O'Connor vein, and as Jeffrey Rosen says, more sweeping, looking for that big kind of absolute statement and running with it.
Well, that's exactly right. And I think, oddly enough, and bear with me here, one of the things that might come out of last week's decision is that, you know, far from being the, marking kind of the Kennedy court, I think that it could begin, it's the beginning of the Roberts court, the beginning of the end of the Kennedy court. Roberts really needed Kennedy to write that opinion. He needed his vote in that decision. We've heard our new Chief Justice talk a lot about reaching decisions in a more narrow way, in a more restrained way. And so if he can get Kennedy to join him on these big cases and to side with the conservatives, it makes it much easier for him to say to the liberals and to say to the court in general, look, do we really want to be fighting over this guy's vote? Why don't we just do things more narrowly in a more restrained way? I'm going to win more often than not. So let's just stop swinging for the fences.
But how does that line up with what issues Jeff Rosen describes, Jeffrey, as the inclination to sweeping decisions, Jen, by Justice Kennedy?
I think it's difficult. And when I asked Justice Scalia about this a few months ago, Roberts wanting to have more narrow decisions, more restrained decisions, he said, you know, lots of luck. But I do think that John Roberts does not want to be presiding over the Kennedy court, just like Rehnquist presided over the O'Connor court.
Jeffrey Rosen, you sat down for a long conversation with Chief Justice Roberts, and it is clear that he's kind of sick of 5-4 decisions, that he doesn't see them as having the strength that they ought to have to carry and guide the country. He'd like much more consensus. Can he possibly get it, given the sort of polarizing issues that this court faces and the different origins of the justices?
Well, he certainly hasn't done too well in the past couple of weeks, obviously. And the fact that he's been on one case on the winning side and the other the losing side of a broad decision whose outcome was controlled by Justice Kennedy just shows how hard the task he has is. He conceded during our conversation that his success was going to turn on his colleagues. He suggested implicitly that Kennedy was going to be going to determine the success or failure. But I do think at some point, Jan is right that he may want to try to persuade the liberals that, given the fact that they're not sure of Kennedy's vote, they'd do better with these narrow decisions that everyone can agree with. But if this term all the big decisions are 5-4, and we have this incredibly sweeping partial birth case and an equally sweeping race case whose outcome is controlled by Justice Kennedy, you really have to ask what chance is there for a success of Roberts' vision. You could have decided these cases on narrower grounds. It would have been possible to uphold the partial birth law without this sweeping language about women's choice and emotions. Mm-hmm. The race case could be decided narrowly. But I guess what I'm saying is that if Roberts decides to take the broad 5-4 decisions in the really controversial cases that everyone cares a lot about and confines his narrow diplomacy to the more obscure cases that people don't care much about, I think you'd have to say that he was not succeeding in the vision that he was laying out to me, and I for one, would be very disappointed if that were the case.
Jeffrey, elaborate on why Chief Justice Roberts so ardently wants to see decisions that don't have this, 5-4 narrow split all the time. Why is that so important to him?
Well, he said it was bad for the court and bad for the country for justices to act more like law professors than members of a collegial court.
What does that mean?
He meant that when each justice views a case as a chance to write some grand theory into the Constitution, to take it to its logical conclusion, to write these broad, sweeping, highly theoretical opinions about the First Amendment, for example, or about race, then people lose confidence in the ability of the court to decide based on law rather than politics, and they also perceive the court as being entirely divided in political rather than jurisprudential terms. So he thought that by persuading his colleagues to resurrect the vision of Chief Justice John Marshall, who was his greatest predecessor and had a knack for winning over ideological opponents, convincing even people who disagreed to join narrow, unanimous opinions that were accepted by the country as a whole during an intensely polarized time, Roberts thought he could allow the court to be seen as an institution above politics in an age when Congress and the president are as polarized as they've ever been. So that was his hope, and he said the way that he tried to do it is by persuading each side that it was in their interest to win 100% of the time narrowly than, 50 or 60% of the time in these narrowly divided opinions. But the success will depend on Kennedy, and right now Kennedy has shown no inclination to buy into this vision. And I'm also curious about what will Roberts signal his own views in the race case. In this case, for example, Kennedy wrote this sweeping opinion. Roberts joined it without any comment
on abortion.
On abortion. If he does the same thing in the race case, say that it's written by Kennedy very broadly, and Roberts joins it without comment, you'd have to say, well, where's that vision of unanimity and compromise you were talking about? Even a separate opinion, a concurrence, where Roberts sort of gives us a sense of how he would have decided things more narrowly, would give hope to those supporters of him, like me, who hope that he really will be able to pull off this vision. But it's a now. On the other hand, you could say it's not fair to judge him by the most controversial cases. These are often 5-4. It's by definition they're the ones in which unanimity is hardest to achieve. When we talked, Robert said to me, you know, people focus on the narrowly divided cases, but we've had a string of more unanimous opinions in a row than any other chief justice in modern history, and no one pays attention to those because they're less controversial.
But aren't the controversial opinions in many ways also the most consequential opinions?
Well, of course they are in the sense they're the ones that the country cares most about and that affect most people's daily lives in the most dramatic ways. But Robert says even the more obscure ones are important because they build a habit of unanimity. Basically, if the justices get into the habit of deciding narrowly and unanimously in these less controversial cases, then they'll be able to carry that on to the broader cases. And that gets back to the question of whether, in the end, Kennedy will go along with this vision. If you had to bet, I'd say, why should he? I mean, this is a man whose strengths and weaknesses, for better or for worse, are a weakness for the grand gesture. He likes running the country. He'd prefer it to be the Kennedy Court rather than the Roberts Court. Why precisely he would want to go along with this vision is not at all clear to me.
So many questions here. It's sort of the Kennedy moment. Jan, look at that for just a moment. Remind us of Justice Kennedy's path to the bench here that might color his view of his role now in his hour.
You know, Justice Kennedy's entire nomination was such a fascinating story. Nominated by President Reagan, he was kind of the last man standing. Remember, the Bork nomination had gone up in flames. There were a core group of lawyers in the Justice Department who were adamantly opposed. I found all this out when I was reporting my book. It was fascinating. They were just adamantly opposed to a guy named Anthony Kennedy out of the Ninth Circuit in California because they believed he was not conservative enough. So then they put up another nominee, Doug Ginsburg, who unfortunately came out that he had smoked pot pretty recently in his past, so then he had to drop out. So, you know, Kennedy was kind of the last man there. Ronald Reagan nominated him, but people knew at the time that he was probably not going to be that solid judicial conservative, certainly not like Robert Bork. So some of this is not a surprise, but Kennedy also has changed since he's been on the court, and conservatives believe that that's a result of kind of cultural drift, external pressures from the media and the academia. I mean, that's the conservative belief on Anthony Kennedy. So he's been subjected to quite an enormous amount of scorn by conservatives, and as Jeffrey was talking about, some of the language he uses is just grating to conservatives. As Scalia has talked about the sweet mysteries of life stuff in some of those abortion decisions that he and Scalia had parted ways on. And so now we see Justice Kennedy writing this opinion for conservatives in the majority. And you see it a kind of grating on the liberals, the language he uses. He talks about the bond of love the mother has for her child. That's like fingernails on the chalkboard for Justice Ginsburg
for
and her dissent.
So,
you know, it's just, so you can see, I think it was wise when we're talking about minimizing Kennedy's role. In a way, it's wise for Roberts. I think he had to give Kennedy this opinion, but the language that Kennedy uses is, you know, I mean, I wonder if some of the liberals are going to want to see that an awful lot in the future in terms of Roberts' efforts to minimize his role and minimize his influence on the court and have the justices stop battling over his vote. Because it's all the things I agree with that Jeffrey said about why Roberts wants more narrow opinions, but I think there's also something motivating him. He wants the court to function as a court, not as a group of nine justices where people are just pitching arguments to one justice and then the decision's going to be based on how that justice happens to see the case.
But tough to get that unanimity on a court or anything close to it when the country is so divided. We'll look more at that. Jan, Jeffrey, I want to get some of our callers in here, if I may, from Washington, D.C. Joe is on the line. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was calling because I was wondering, given the fact that it looks like, at least in some of the controversial opinions, the abortion one being a top example, why didn't the Democrats push harder? I mean, I know they had the Gang of 14 to sort of act as a firewall against a filibuster, but it seems like the conservatives might have won the day on that one.
But how could they push harder? The justices are already appointed. The Democrats are not in the White House. Where's the push? Where's the political push when it comes to a Supreme Court decision?
Well, not the decision so much, but the nomination of Alito and Roberts, that they didn't stand more against them, knowing that they would push the court even further to the right than it is, than it was at the time. And now you've got a couple of justices. One of them is in his 80s, and it looks like that might be another opportunity in the next couple of years for the Bush administration.
Yeah, so we're going to look more at the presidential politics behind that. But what about it, Jan Crawford Greenberg? Joe suggesting, you know, the die may be cast here. We may be headed toward a more conservative legal framework for this country's life because, hey, the Alito and Roberts are on the court, and that's that.
Well, I think there's no question that this is a more conservative court. Just having Alito replace Justice O'Connor turns this court to the right in a way that we haven't seen, for a decade or so. And, you know, the whole story of the confirmation of Roberts and Alito, you had Republicans in control, and then the way the thing came down, we knew about Alito. The Democrats felt like they had the smoking gun. They had memos he had written where he said he was proud of his work in opposing Roe versus Wade. Mm. But I think Alito was such an effective witness. You know, he was kind of reserved, almost slumped down in a seat, very mm-hmm. quiet, patient. That it was, I mean, I covered those hearings and I cover it in my book, and it's like the fight kind of left the room. The Democrats kind of mounted an effort to oppose him at the end, but it was really too late. I mean, they started those hearings thinking, you know, they were going to, and the groups in opposition thought that they were going to be able to oppose Alito. And then they never were able to kind of get back on track after the first day or two.
And now we've got a Chief Justice who's something like 52 years old. He's got a long way ahead of him. Samuel Alito, a fairly young man in court terms as well. Max is calling from Boston. Max, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
All right. What do you know, Max?
Well, I was deeply disturbed by this recent decision on abortion, but for a reason I haven't really heard discussed.
Mm.
It seems to me that if I were a woman and interested and rich and could afford, say, travel to France or Germany, I could afford one of these late-term abortions. And, I mean, I know that's a couple hypotheticals right there, but there are people who can afford to leave the country and still have access to these procedures. And the court used to be very, very hesitant to grant people protections based on class.
Mm-hmm.
And now, I don't know, maybe I'll take my comments.
So you're concerned that a poor woman who suddenly, late term, feels she can't go forward with this, won't have the same options as someone with more resources, Jeffrey Rosen, did that come into this decision at all? When they look at dilation and extraction, so-called partial birth, were class issues considered?
Not so much. The caller is absolutely right that in general, abortion restrictions tend to disfavor especially poor women. It's tricky because the states that tend to have the most serious restrictions on abortions already have very few abortion providers. So in North Dakota, for example, there are only two in the state. Mostly you have to travel out of state to get an abortion. If you don't have money to do that, it's going to be harder in general to get the abortion. But what makes this case so tricky and complicated and vexing for some people is that this really isn't about denying women abortion. It's about banning a particular and rather gruesome procedure that, at least according to the majority of the court, can still be used as long as you essentially, well, kill the fetus in utero before engaging in the procedure. So it's more about symbols. It's about moral clashes. It's about the politics of abortion. But if the court's majority is to be believed, no one who could have gotten an abortion in the old days will be denied it under this law because it's very easy to get around the law either by using a similar procedure or just with this medical procedure that will allow the abortion to take place. That doesn't in any way minimize the importance of the caller's concern about the fact that now in this new age, as legislatures are freer to ban especially later term abortions, those future regulations will absolutely fall most heavily on poor women. They're the ones who will suffer from a more seriously regulatory regime. But this particular decision doesn't have very dramatic class implications, I think.
Mm, because it's not practiced very often, first of all, but still, there's something embedded there. Let's go to a call from Columbia, South Carolina. Joe, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. The Kennedy Court, this Kennedy Court frightens me to death, sir.
Why?
Because it's going to take the country backwards. I see Kennedy being lining up for the most part with conservatives, and it's going to strike down eventually Roe v. Wade, and maybe even some civil rights laws. I think that's what it, that's what they put these people on court to do, and that's what they're going to try to do.
So watch out. You see it. What looks to you like reverse? Of course, you've got conservatives celebrating these changes. We had Richard Land, who does a policy for the Southern Baptist Convention, saying, thank God for President Bush after this victory. We're on our way here. Jan Crawford Greenberg, what about it? You mentioned race in schools. Roe v. Wade. I mean, Joe in South Carolina says these things look vulnerable to him. Are the implications that we might have more and more restrictions on abortions coming down the pike? Are we going to have less latitude to look at the racial makeup of our schools, racially segregated schools again?
Well, I certainly think we're going to have more restrictions and more regulations on abortion. If you look at the language, it really retools some of the debate on abortion. Justice Kennedy's opinion suggests that states do have a role. States can make moral choices. States can actively seek to discourage abortion. But Roe versus Wade is not on the table. Justice Kennedy is not going to provide that, you know, fifth vote. We don't know how Roberts and Alito would vote on that either. So right now, we have two justices on this court we know would like to see Roe overturned, and I don't think we're going to see that happen anytime, you know, in the future. But what we will see is states that can impose more regulation and restriction on abortion. For example, we're going to see some more of these kind of informed consent laws that South Carolina has been thinking about and asking women to making women view ultrasounds of fetuses before abortion. I think that's probably legal in the constitutional in the wake of this decision. So we'll maybe see some fetal pain statutes. So I think you are going to see states now taking a more active role in passing laws that might limit or seek to discourage abortion. And I think in the wake of this decision, those laws are pretty clearly constitutional. But Roe is not on the table. The basic right to an abortion is not at issue. And I certainly don't think Kennedy would agree to that. And we don't know what Roberts and Alito would do at this point. On other cases, on race cases, Justice Kennedy has been very consistent in that area over the years in opposing affirmative action. Justice O'Connor always provided that key fifth vote with the liberals to uphold some of those programs. So I do think that we are going to see a turn on some of those race cases as well, and we'll see that this term.
What does that mean in practical terms? I'm reading prognostications of hundreds of school systems having to change their policies about school integration. Will it be as stark as that? Are we going to see a different complexion, Jeffrey Rosen, in American public schools once this court has done its work?
If this case is decided broadly, it could indeed have very sweeping implications, more dramatic, in fact, than the partial birth case, which is a largely symbolic law. If the case is written broadly, then, as you said, suggest hundreds of schools that now use race as a factor in making school assignments that limit parental choice by using race as a tiebreaker in order to mirror the racial composition of their communities as a whole, could have to change their school systems. And what's so interesting and significant and dramatic about this, to confirm the caller's concerns, is that the Supreme Court in recent years has not reached decisions that require radical retooling of broadly accepted social practices. One reason that the court upheld affirmative action under Justice O'Connor's leadership was because of the briefs filed by the military, who said that the military would have to change its practices, and it shouldn't have to do that because that would harm national security.
Sarah's calling from Burlington, Vermont. Sarah, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi. What do you know?
Excuse me?
What do you see going on here, Sarah?
Well, my comment was just that I think that it's a little bit short-sighted for people to become so wrapped up in what's going on that they don't see this as a malleable process. And I'm not just talking about the Supreme Court itself, but I'm actually talking about its existence. You know, our political system is sure to change in the next 100 years or so, and although that might not make a big difference for me, I think that people have to start seeing that that's a possibility, because if they don't see the possibility for change, it won't happen.
Well, I'm not sure what you mean. We're going to jettison democracy and do something else, or we'll have more effective democracy.
No.
How does that affect?
No, but, you know, you have to look at the Supreme Court and wonder, is it really right that 9 justices get to decide a presidential election when those justices were, in fact, appointed by political parties that were, you know, previously in power between 2 political parties? That doesn't seem like a lasting system. And it seems, if you look at the rest of the world, with all the political systems in the world that are democratic in the West, those, even the way that they do politics, has changed since World War II, since, you know, 100 years ago.
So there's a really long-term perspective, looking beyond the makeup of this court, looking beyond even the way justices may be appointed. Of course, that's going to be big, already is a hot issue in the presidential campaign that's beginning to rev up. I want to turn for just a moment, if we may, to Karen Tumulty. She joins us from Washington, national political correspondent for Time magazine. Karen, thanks very much for being here.
Well, thank you, Tom.
So it's a hot potato, of course, whenever abortion comes on the scene. How did candidates respond to last week's abortion decision?
Well, largely, you know, with press releases, that basically the Republicans all applauded it, and the Democrats were either silent about it or, you know, expressed concern about it.
Barack Obama saying, "I strongly disagree with today's Supreme Court ruling." Rudy Giuliani, who supported abortion rights, saying the court reached the correct conclusion.
That's right. That's right. And, of course, what this is at this point is, you know, everybody is playing to their primary base. But the fact is that the reason that the anti-abortion forces pushed this issue was that it proved a great wedge issue with Democrats. You know, this was something that you know, really made a lot of Democrats very, very uncomfortable because it focused on a procedure that a lot of people found, you know, immoral, and even people who could support abortion under other circumstances. And, you know, you had Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan calling it infanticide. So, you know, this has always been, I think, much more of a political issue than a legal issue or a medical issue.
But here we are in the middle of a political season with the abortion piece already on the table and campaign financing and free speech and race in schools coming up. Could the court, in effect, be the institution that brings wedge issues back into the race after Iraq had largely pushed them to the margins, Karen?
I think that is very likely to be the case because if for no other reasons than that this forces Democrats to talk about them, and they don't, you know, this is something that they for the last couple of cycles have not felt comfortable about.
Karen, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
Karen Tumulty of Time magazine. Jeffrey Rosen, do you see court justices looking over their shoulder at presidential campaign politics and calculating who may be next to join them on the bench as a result?
Yes, although some do it much more explicitly than others. When the court decided Roe v. Wade, remarkably, the Chief Justice, Berger, decided to delay the decision, partly because he didn't want to affect the presidential election,
mm-hmm.
so that the Republicans might be harmed. Other justices are more subtle in the way that they follow the election returns, to use the famous saw. Speaking very broadly, the court has tended, over time, to reflect the constitutional views of a majority of the American people, and when the country has become more conservative, so has the court, and vice versa. That's why the previous caller's broad statements that really the court in 100 years may not be around because it's challenging democracy so dramatically is right in the sense that if the court actually did do things the country didn't want, it would get into trouble, but it really hasn't done that. The Rehnquist Court, or the O'Connor Court, was remarkably adept at expressing the views of the median voter with exquisite precision, you know, just tinkering around the edges, but never really challenging the country. What makes the moment that we're entering so interesting, and you put it very well, as did Karen Tumulty, by saying the court might be restoring wedge issues to the table, if the court starts doing things that substantial minorities or even majorities of the country don't like, requiring a complete retooling of the school systems, for example, or to look forward to next year, striking down gun laws in a dramatic way, which it hasn't done since the 1930s and which it might well do next year. If it gets into that habit, if it takes a unilateralist turn, then there might be a political backlash of the kind that we haven't really seen since the 1930s, which was the last time the court started challenging the political system. And that's where Roberts' vision that we were talking about earlier will be so crucial. Will he, as he promised to, calibrate the court so that it is essentially in tune with the wishes of a majority of the country, or is he going to take it down this unilateralist path that could provoke a backlash? I hope that he has this political skill and also historical sense to realize the dangers of judicial unilateralism, but as we're discussing this morning, it's starting down a dangerous path, and anything's possible.
A lot of fascinating nuance there. Jan Crawford-Greenberg, in a time when, I mean, if the court were, and I'm sure they would not concede this, but if they were tracking the median voter, not so clear where the median voter is right now.
I think that you could say The court, sure, I mean, it's hard to track the median voter, but I mean, the court last week did uphold a bipartisan federal law that had 16 or 17 Democrats voting for it. Mm. And, you know, the court 7 years ago struck down state laws that had been passed by 31-2 different states. So, you know, there is an argument that this court still is kind of tracking that moderate median voter, whether or not it's doing so intentionally or not. You know, and the same with the race case that we will see in the next month or two. You know, it's kind of hard to say if the court is walking away from what the editorial pages of the New York Times may be wanting is one thing, but I still don't see any evidence that it's veering that dramatically from what the median voter at this point is wanting, assuming that they are following the election returns, which some do, as Jeffrey says, and some don't. Some of the justices don't even read the articles that are written about the court because they don't want their decisions to be influenced by external public opinion.
Yeah, let's take a call from New Haven, Connecticut. Frank, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Excellent show, excellent guests as usual.
Thank you.
I myself am troubled by one aspect of this decision, which I don't think has gotten enough attention, and that is that this was a decision by five Catholic justices cynically appointed by Republican presidents because of their abortion views. That's very troubling to me. Of course, I have to admit they're not exactly walking in lockstep with the Pope and the American Catholic bishops on the death penalty issue.
But what are you suggesting there, Frank? That there should be a limit on the number of Catholics on the U.S. Supreme Court?
No, I think that the cynicism of the process that put them on there should be discussed more openly. That was the litmus test for the appointment of every single one of those justices. And it's finally come to fruition.
It's an interesting observation. Jan, what do you say?
Well, I mean, I have to take strong issue with that. Number one, that these justices were nominated because of their religion. And number two, that this decision last week was dictated by their religious views. I flatly disagree with that. I mean, I think that the flip side of that argument could be that these justices, you know, read the Constitution in a way that deferred to the will of the people and the will of the Congress and certainly the will of 31 or 2 state legislatures if the state laws had been at issue. So, you know, we've seen kind of a growing anti-Catholic backlash, oddly enough, in the last week or so. Rosie O'Donnell made some comments on The View, and then the former dean of my law school at the University of Chicago wrote a blog suggesting that the only reason that these five justices voted to uphold this law was because of their religious beliefs. And I actually think that that's I don't think that's true. But it's also a somewhat dangerous road to go down and pretty offensive if you think about it.
Jeffrey Rosen, it's easy to see how that could be a dangerous road to go down. On the other hand, our caller Frank suggests that the road's been gone down already, cynically, in the appointment of these particular justices. Do you see a religion card working in this decision?
I don't, and I have to agree more with Jan. Mm-hmm. I mean, the caller's suggestion is provocative. You could flip it and say the fact that we have that many Catholics on the court suggests the irrelevance of religion. In the old days, you could only get appointed if you filled a particular religious or geographical seat. Mm-hmm. Now we care more about racial and gender diversity and about politics above all. So the fact that it wasn't even especially an issue that Roberts and Alito were Catholic suggests that that's not viewed as a decisive factor. And, of course, these are very different kinds of Catholics. Justice Kennedy has made clear his desire to protect early-term abortion. Scalia and Thomas are clearly opposed to early-term abortions. So to say in any simple way that religion dictates political outcomes would have to be wrong. Now, is it more likely that religious people tend to be conservative? Yes, according to the polls. Are Catholics more likely to be socially conservative? I suppose broadly the polls suggest that idea as well. But there are so many wrinkles in this debate that if you're trying to play Kremlinology on the Supreme Court, judicial philosophy would be much more important than religion in trying to figure out how people were actually going to vote.
Let's take a call from Florence, South Carolina, and Mike. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, sir. I guess I'm going to talk as one of those quote-unquote religious people. I haven't heard very many comments on the side favoring the Supreme Court justice decision, which I certainly do. My nephew is a byproduct of the fact that because South Carolina had a more restrictive abortion restriction after the first trimester, mm-hmm. The young lady that I used to be her minister allowed my sister to adopt the son that was born to her and her husband. And this is a fine young man, a 10-year-old little boy now that's going to grow into a fine young man. Mm. And if that restriction had not been in place, he would not be here today. So my view is that I truly do believe that abortion is murder. And I think that the more restrictiveness that can be put forward in that regard, the better.
Mike, let me ask you then, you're celebrating that nephew that's alive there, but what about the court? Do you expect it to go further with this makeup or perhaps with a future makeup? Do you expect, are you longing for Roe v. Wade to be overturned?
I truly do. Yes, sir. I truly do hope it will be overturned one day. Yes,
do you think we're headed in that direction?
I do. I do believe we are headed in that direction. I have two daughters of my own, age 12 and age 9. They are young ladies, and even though I've got daughters, I still believe that Roe versus Wade should be overturned. Yes, sir.
Mike, thanks very much for your call. Jan Crawford-Greenberg, you've written about the effect of Justice Thomas on Sandra Day O'Connor. I wish you'd describe that, how he sort of turned her in a more liberal direction with his brand of conservative thought. And give us a sense of how you're reading those interpersonal dynamics now. Does it make a difference, personality-wise, where this court might turn, how they interact chemistry with each other?
Oh, there's no question. And Jeffrey has just written a terrific book about this as well, looking back historically at how the issue of personality and group dynamics can affect the way the Supreme Court decides all these incredibly significant issues. You know, when Justice Thomas came on the court, he was this independent, forceful conservative, never just following Scalia like people had said at the time. That's just flatly untrue. Very much his own person, his own thinker. But that kind of produced this kind of counterintuitive result. We had this much more conservative court, but that year the court turned to the left. It caused Justice O'Connor in particular to back away from some of those strong conservative views. So the question now is, we've got a new justice in Justice Alito, a new conservative justice, a new chief justice. How are those group dynamics going to shake out? What is that going to mean for coalitions and building coalitions? Justice White always said a new justice makes a new court. Here we have two new justices. But I think that, you know, the president, when he was thinking about who to put on that court, he got that. I mean, he understood the whole issue of group dynamics. He nominated two justices who are collegial, congenial guys, very savvy, unlikely to push away that pivotal guy in the middle, Justice Kennedy. So I think that Roberts and Alito are going to be very effective at building coalitions, which then, of course, would move the court even more to the right than some of the things that we've seen.
Jeffrey Rosen, what about the greenhouse gas environmental decision of just a couple of weeks ago now? That seemed to lean in the other direction, and Chief Justice Roberts was very upset by it. Interpret that for us. Where does that one come from? What does it suggest?
Those are tricky to put on traditional liberal and conservative axes, because the liberals basically said we have to defer to the will of Congress in requiring this kind of regulation.
And this was allowing the EPA to intervene in cases on greenhouse gases. The conservative argument was that that's not their place to be there.
The conservative argument was that the EPA could make a decision not to regulate, and because it was an executive agency controlled by the president, the court should defer to the president's policy decision that a certain amount of regulation was not necessary. The liberals said, no, Congress is very clear about what kind of regulation is necessary here, and if the president and the EPA completely ignore that requirement, then the court has to intervene. Basically, it was a clash between two separate kinds of deference, and we did see here the fact that Justices Roberts and Alito, joined by Kennedy and Scalia, are very eager to defer to presidential authority. They think that administrative agencies should have almost total discretion to follow the president's prerogatives. That's consistent with their views in terrorism cases, where they're reluctant to second-guess the president's power as commander-in-chief, whereas the liberals were more deferential to Congress. It doesn't necessarily tell us, you know, which way Justice Kennedy is going to go in these moral cases. But it reminds us that there we had Kennedy, who was very willing to have an activist court basically telling the executive what to do, a judicial supremacist who had no compunction about having the court be at the center of this policy and regulatory debate.
Jan, we've got just half a minute here, but could that mean that the court would be tougher on presidential authority, even as it became more conservative on some social issues?
Yes, absolutely. And that's an area where we're going to see the influence of Justice Kennedy, because he has been much more willing to take a skeptical look at some of the arguments the president's made in the war on terror. So I don't think that this court is turning sharply and firmly to the right, because those are the cases where Kennedy's vote will still really make a difference.
So plenty of nuance here, but it looks like big changes on the way at the same time. It's been great speaking with both of you. Jan Crawford Greenberg at ABC News, author of Supreme Conflict, The Inside Story of the Struggle for Control of the United States Supreme Court. It was a great read, Jan, and we appreciate your comments today. Thanks for being with
us. Thank you.
And Jeffrey Rosen, author of The Supreme Court, The Personalities and Rivalries That Defined America. Always great hearing from you, Jeffrey. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.